Cool. So, hey everyone, thanks for the introduction, Matt, and thanks for being here, especially given that it's the second talk today already. So, like Matt was saying, I'll be talking about non-Gaussianities today, but I guess the central topic here really is in the second half of the title, mainly thinking about slow roll violations. So I guess the very basic picture normally that we have in the simplest inflationary models, at least we have some single degree of freedom, and we consider these models quite often subject to slow roll conditions that somehow simplify the dynamics of the field through an early inflationary phase. And I guess what we'll try and do here is really try and ask and address two questions. So question number one is going to be, how far away do observations actually allow us to go away from this extreme slow roll limit? Can we place some observational bounds on these slow roll parameters? If we have some inflationary phase, how close to the slow roll limit do we actually have to be? And question number two is kind of related to that then. In the transition between the extreme slow roll case and the regime where we saturate the bounds that I'll show you that we'll derive, is there any interesting phenomenology that pops in along the way and that's somehow associated generically with slow roll violations? I guess also to some extent, this is sort of related to the final slide almost of the talk this morning. So there, Bing-An was trying to propose some sort of phenomenological treatment in terms of the curvature perturbation for ekpyrotic style models. So I guess to some extent, what we're doing here is the same for an inflationary style model, where we're not trying to do model building, but we're somehow saying there's a single degree of freedom, might be scalar field, composite scalar. Somehow there's a single degree of freedom out there. And we're trying to phenomenologically constrain, by looking at different observations, what that effective theory for a single degree of freedom in an inflationary setup is. Okay, so now let's see how this works. Right, so quick outline before I start. So we're going to quickly go over the effective field theories that I'll be talking about, and I'll set up exactly what sort of slow roll conditions I have in mind, because there's a few available in the literature, I suppose. Some generic signatures for these slow rolling models. And then I'll tell you exactly about what sort of slow roll violations I have in mind, how I parameterize them. And then eventually we'll go over to some signatures of these slow roll violating models. And I guess, as you can see, most of them will be associated with non-Gaussianities, which I suppose in hindsight justifies the title. But we'll have some few other candidates as well here. Okay, so there we go. And so I was promising to derive these constraints on slow roll parameters as well. And this is the place where they'll be coming from, but we'll meet them as we go along and as we're on our way. So I'll be deriving constraints on these slow roll parameters as we go along and go through these different aspects here in the talk. Okay. So again, we're considering some inflationary phase in the early universe here. Actually, a couple of years back, there was something similar done also by people here at PI, Justin Curry and Federico Piazza, who's also working on this stuff with us, for contracting style models. But here we're thinking of some simple inflationary phase, and I guess the standard WMAP cartoon is something like this. So we have some early stage in the expansion, we have some quantum fluctuations or maybe thermal fluctuations. They get magnified by some inflationary phase and essentially become the seeds for the formation of structure as we go along in the history of the universe. In particular, they'll become imprinted on the CMB and eventually act as seeds for the formation of stars, galaxies, etc. I suppose the simplest way we could think of in an inflationary context of realizing such an inflationary phase is just some single scalar field action where we have the Einstein-Hilbert gravity term, we have some canonical kinetic term for this single degree of freedom phi, and we endow this field with some potential V, and then subject to certain constraints in the potential, we can realize an inflationary phase in the early universe. And so eventually we want to be a bit more general than that, and I guess we'll come back to the PX phi models discussed this morning as well. And I suppose the rationale behind considering these models is that you can still stay within the single field paradigm, but start considering more general models by, for example, introducing high derivative interactions. So instead of having a canonical kinetic term in something like this, we can have some sort of function here which depends on fine higher order derivatives. But we have to keep in mind that really in the context here, we're working with an effective field theory. So it's going to be valid up to some cutoff scale, Planck scale perhaps, maybe some other scale. And higher derivatives of my field phi are going to be suppressed by higher and higher powers of whatever my cutoff scale is going to be. So I suppose an interesting limit is one where I can basically chop off these higher derivatives, I say they're too suppressed to be considering them, and have some sort of minimal higher derivative theory, I suppose, where I only have a function of the field in its first derivative. And if I now impose Lorentz invariance from action as well, that actually forces my first derivative to enter in the form of this canonical kinetic term for the field here. So I end up with these PX phi theories. So right, so there's some, I need to stay polite here. There's sometimes a little bit of dishonesty, I suppose, in the way PX phi theories are presented, because of course, if you might have a theory which is of this form, but for which this argument doesn't really hold anymore, because like you say, if I consider x squared, x to the higher power terms, then in terms of suppression of the cutoff scale, I should also be considering other theories. There might be other reasons why I chop off the other terms, but in principle, like you say, this kind of comes in with, say there's some square root expansion, I should really be ignoring higher order powers of x as well, if this argument holds.
Have you really heard the reason for cutting off the higher order terms having to do with the initial value problem?
Yeah.
Right, so you can think of, the
last... is generically pathological, and you have to argue that what you're doing makes sense.
Cool. So this is kind of the fiducial set of the theories we're playing with here. But I suppose in general, what I'll be saying is quite straightforwardly generalizable to more generic effective field theories for a single degree of freedom. So you know, Galilean-style theories, other theories where you have higher order derivatives as well. But the fiducial model we'll be playing with here is one of these PX phi theories. Okay, so now, what do I mean by a slow-ruling single field here? And again, let me be a little bit pedantic here, because there's different conventions on the market. So we have our PX phi theory here, and we now have two sets of hierarchies of slow roll parameters that contain a lot of the information about the evolution of the background and the perturbations. In particular, we have the standard hierarchy, also have the canonical case of slow roll parameters, eta, epsilon, and so on, that essentially measure time derivatives of my Hubble scale H. And then I essentially have a mirror image here on the other side, which is the same for the speed of sound CS. So essentially the parameter that measures how quickly my perturbations move around, or as we'll see, it also somehow is a measure of how non-canonical my theory is here, how non-canonical the kinetic term is. So I have these two sets of hierarchies here, and just essentially by definition, if my epsilon parameter is smaller than one, then I'm in an inflationary regime. But with slow roll conditions, I'm actually a lot more restrictive here. I actually want all these parameters to be much, much smaller than one. So, for example, in that sense, I guess then my background is very slowly varying. And that's really what I'll take my slow roll conditions to be. And I suppose you can define alternative definitions in terms of some potential, et cetera. But these slow variation conditions are really, I guess, rather than slow roll conditions, are a more general set of conditions we can impose here. And that's what I mean when I'll be talking about slow rolling single fields. Say again?
In that definition, the derivative of an eta, so they can be big.
Right. So in principle, I've just stopped here. But in principle, you know, I could keep going. And I guess I'll, you know, as a matter of notation, I'll be referring to something where this whole expansion, everything's much smaller than one, a slow roll. But yeah, in principle, you could have higher order parameters. And in principle, you could think about cases where they are, where the higher order parameters are large. We'll talk about that later on.
Sorry, what S mean?
So this is just the CS, the speed of sound parameter. So it's related to this function here, but it basically tells you how quickly perturbations move around in the medium. I'll give you an exact definition for it later on. But yeah, it's just essentially another hierarchy here. Okay. So then again, related to what we were hearing early on, really what we're shooting for in the end here, I suppose, is really to link this up with some observational measure of in particular curvature perturbations. And I guess a different way of phrasing what we were saying early on in this WMAP cartoon is we really have these some perturbations, fluctuations in the early universe, for example, quantum fluctuations, in the metric and in the matter, where I'm only showing you the metric bit here. And we can package them nicely into the stage invariant form zeta here, and then essentially talk about the evolution of primordial curvature perturbations throughout the history of the universe described by this parameter zeta here. And now we can essentially measure the primordial contribution at loads of various scales that we can observe. So we can look at the CMB and try and learn something there about this primordial curvature perturbation. We can perhaps look at large-scale structure and hopefully in the not-too-distant future perhaps use 21 centimeter surface as well to fill some of the gaps in the middle. So in principle, over a whole range of scale, we should be able to disentangle some of this primordial information. I guess a lot of the information that we're really after is in these correlation functions. We've only shown the 2- and 3-point correlation function of my primordial curvature perturbation. So in particular for the 2-point function, of course, we have the power spectrum and the associated spectral index, et cetera, that we can observe. Although we haven't observed anything yet, I suppose, in terms of non-Gaussianities, the 3-point functions, we can look at the bi-spectrum and, in principle, measure non-Gaussian information, and then that way also learn something about the primordial curvature perturbation, and that way also learn about our inflationary physics going on at early times. And I guess the one of the simplest ways conceptually of seeing how they're related, I suppose, is, for example, the CMB scales. I can essentially read off my curvature perturbation zeta directly from the temperature and anisotropies, and then form various observables essentially by looking at these higher order correlation functions. Okay, so now the question that I'm asking on this slide is really whether for some PX5 theory that we're considering, in the extreme Slorer limit where all these Slorer parameters are much smaller than one, is there something generic we can say about what we can observe by looking at correlation functions, for example, in the CMB? And the answer is yes, there is. And I'm picking out two different things here. So thing number one is I'm looking at the 3-point correlation function. And what we find for theories of this type, with all these parameters being much, much smaller than one, is that we find that predominantly the 3-point function peaks when these three different k vectors that come in with each of the different zetas are of about the same order of magnitude. So we have an equilateral contribution like so. And we've seen actually plots of this type in a yeast talk 2 days ago, the ones you're here, but I'll explain the plots later on in a bit more detail. Note that the predominantly here is there for a good reason, because it's not quite true that we always get equilateral non-Gaussianities, and there's actually smaller regions in parameter space where we can get folded and orthogonal in non-Gaussianities as well, which again we'll meet later on. But for the majority of parameter space, a generic statement, we will find equilateral non-Gaussianities here. And the second important thing is that we find a negligible running NNG. So what that really means is that the new scale invariance of the 2-point function for these models maps to my 3-point function, to the non-Gaussianities. So whatever level of non-Gaussianity I have, for example, in CMB scales, I essentially expect the same level when I go to different scales, so galaxy cluster scales, galaxy bispector, etc. So my non-Gaussian 3-point function here doesn't depend on what scale I'm looking at. So that's true of the generics. We'll keep in mind, and we'll see that they are no longer true when we start moving away from the limit where all these parameters are small. Okay. So now, what sort of Slorer violations am I thinking of? And that links to your point early on of thinking about variation of the higher order parameters. So what I'll be doing is thinking of a very simple type of Slorer violation here, which is sort of almost of the opposite type, namely one where at the first level in this hierarchy, so again, I have my epsilon, eta, and so on for h, I have my epsilon s, eta s, et cetera, for the speed of sound. So what I'm thinking of here is a very simple case where I have this first level in the hierarchy, and I won't constrain these parameters to be much smaller than one at all anymore. So in principle, for now, I'll allow them to take any value they want, and then we'll try to constrain them later on. But I think of the simple case where these are still nearly constant. So I guess, in other words, higher order parameters are still suppressed. And to all intents and purposes, these parameters will dominate, and I can essentially ignore them, which is just a different way of saying that these higher order parameters are still slower or suppressed. I suppose that's, in some sense, complementary to other types of Slorer violations that people have been thinking of. For example, the generalized Slorer approach that Cora and Wayne Hu here have been thinking of, where really what you're saying is the opposite, where you're saying you have some slow rolling phase here, but you think of some feature-like behavior, some mass steps in the potential, something of that sort that gives you some sort of oscillatory feature and these higher order parameters. You break slow roll in these higher order parameters here. So we'll essentially be thinking of the complementary limit, where we have some sort of slow roll breaking at the background level, but we still have these parameters nearly constant, so slow roll conditions holding for these higher order parameters. Just as a simple way of making this analytically manageable and trying to get some intuition here. Okay, so you might think this is kind of doomed right from the start, right? Because from from I guess, the purely canonical models, we're really used to thinking of the two-point correlation function and seeing that if we want an Ely scale invariant two-point correlation function, that immediately tells me I have to be somewhere in the slow roll regime. And the interesting thing here now with these two different hierarchies and potentially non-canonical terms is that's no longer the case. So if I compute my two-point correlation function, in particular if I work out my associated spectral index NS here, what I find is this relation here where the exact form really isn't important. What is important is it's a three-way constraint between the spectral index and these two slow roll parameters, epsilon and epsilon S here. And what you can kind of see straight away is that given any spectral index I want, so whether I want to make this exactly scale invariant or something else, I can essentially make my epsilon parameter as big as I want if I compensate with an appropriately fine-tuned epsilon S parameter here. So what that's really telling me is that in terms of a model-independent bound for my slow roll parameter epsilon here or epsilon S, this doesn't really get me anywhere. Because given any spectral index, I can always match these two so that they conspire to give me a nearly scale invariant two-point function. Now, you can argue about how natural that is, but in terms of absolute bounds on the slow roll parameters, this really doesn't get me anywhere. So now, let's go one up, I guess, and we'll finally be able to do better there. So we'll be looking at three-point correlation functions, and I guess there's at the very least, three different interesting things that we can be talking about. So we'll talk about essentially a one-value measure of the three-point correlation function, this FNL parameter here. And in particular, I'll be thinking about an FNL parameter that's defined in the equilateral limit, so where all these different k's are the same, which is kind of justified again in hindsight by the fact, like we were saying earlier on, we expect non-Gaussianities to peak in this equilateral limit, so that's really the most interesting case we kind of think of. Then we can think about the running, and remember in the slow roll case, we were saying we basically have scale invariance of my three-point function, hence my FNL parameter here. And here we'll see that that's no longer the case. There's actually some scale dependence in the three-point function. And then finally, all the information we've thrown away in looking at this FNL in a particular limit, we can start looking at the full shape space, because of course this bispectrum here is really a function of the magnitude of all these different k vectors. And looking at the full shape of the full functional form of this alpha give us some extra information as well. So that's the different aspects of my non-Gaussianities we'll be looking at here. But let's kind of take a step back here, I guess, and think about what we're really doing when we're computing these three-point correlation functions. So from a purely QFT type point of view, what we're doing here is really we're looking at some interaction Hamiltonian, and essentially the action of the perturbations to cubic order. And luckily, Dave Seary and Jim Lindsay have already done that for us for generic PX5 models. And what we find is we find some cubic action of this form here. Now, I don't want to get bogged down in the details, but you can already kind of get some intuition of what you might expect if you go away from the slow roll limit. Because really, we have essentially what are interaction vertices from the QFT point in terms of my curvature perturbation zeta here. And we find these essentially different coupling constants that are functions or proportional to my slow roll parameters epsilon. So I guess a naive expectation I might have is that when I go away from the slow roll limit, these couplings will become larger, so probably I'll get some increased level of non-Gaussianity as sort of naive intuition here, I suppose. And another interesting aspect we can already glean off is that in terms of this FNL parameter, so some, I guess, simplified measure of the overall amplitude of this, we find that it actually only depends on two parameters, essentially the speed of sound that we were talking about earlier on, which now you can see is given in terms of my function p like so. And these extra parameters, lambda and sigma, which essentially measure also higher derivatives of my function p here. And I guess if Ghazal and Rachel Bean, you're interested in reconstructing inflationary actions, that also makes this interesting, because looking at non-Gaussianities essentially allows you to constrain higher order derivative terms in your effective inflationary action. But for now, so I guess there's actually some simple parametric dependence. And from just looking at that, I suppose, some intuition we might have about what happens when we go away from slow roll, so we might get increased non-Gaussianities. Now, turns out that's not the case. And that's kind of quite interesting, because again, this kind of goes against our intuition. So what I'm doing here really is, for now, as a first case to keep things simple and show you some nice diagram, I'm thinking of the case where essentially this first vertex dominates. There's nothing deep about that. I'll show you the full expressions later on. But just for now, to keep things simple and fitting on a slide, thinking of the case where the first vertex dominates, and we essentially have an equilateral FNL, which is sort of in this form. And the game we were playing on this slide is the following. So I'm defining some parameters like my spectral index, my speed of sound parameter, etc., somehow so that at a given scale, I have an FNL of the order of 100 or so. So if I do that at a CMB scale, that's still well within bounds from WMAP. And the game I'm playing now is... Right, yeah, so from, let's see how far back I have to go. Yeah, so essentially I'm assuming these to be constant by ignoring these higher order parameters. So there's no time variation in these first order parameters. As a kind of, you know, first order guess at the answer, rather than saying there's anything deep about these parameters being constant. So hang on, let's see how far I have to go back. Okay. So again, the game we're playing is we're somehow fixing parameters, say on CMB scales, to get an FNL of the order of 100 or so, so within WMAP bounds. And now what we're saying is, keeping all the other parameters the same, we're now going from the slower limit, where epsilon is much, much smaller than 1, essentially to some different regime, where I keep increasing my epsilon. We'll see later on why I only go up to 0.3. But for now, just think of increasing my epsilon parameter, keeping all the other parameters the same. And what we find, interestingly, is that actually, contrary to our intuition that I was trying to get from the cubic action earlier on, my non-Gaussianity actually gets decreased in my level of non-Gaussianity. And that's quite remarkable in two aspects. Because one, the suppression is really rather strong here, right? We're really suppressing by about an order of magnitude or so in the amplitude of the three-point function we're seeing here. And that really means, I guess, that in terms of parameter space constraints, that becomes interesting. Because if I somehow try to constrain the parameters of my theory in the slow roll limit, really what I'm saying here is that I've got much more wiggle room when I start going away from slow roll, because I get some natural suppression of the three-point function. So it becomes much easier to stay within bounds from, for example, the WMAP experiment, so that, in fact, the parameter space that becomes observationally viable now becomes much larger when I start looking at models where this epsilon parameter isn't small. But I guess the main question that still remains here is, have I actually cheated, right? I've only shown you some case where one of the operators dominates, so maybe I've just fortuitously zoned in on some region of parameter space where accidentally there's some sort of epsilon effect that decreases, but actually, in fact, in general, the intuition was right, and there's really no effect if I consider a generic theory like that. Turns out, that's not the case. So I'm not showing you the full expressions for the full amplitude alpha here, because it would be rather horrific. But what I am showing you is, so in terms of actually building up the full bi-spectrum from contributions from all the different vertices I have in my cubic action, what I'll have is an answer that's essentially a linear composition of these different amplitudes here. And again, the form of these amplitudes is not really relevant. What we find, though, is we find this pre-factor essentially sitting in front of all of these different amplitudes here. And if we go back to the case I was showing you, that's really where all the magic happens. So this cos gamma factor over here, that's really what's giving you the overall suppression when you start going to higher values of the epsilon parameter. Now, where does it actually come from? Is, I guess, the interesting question. And in order to show you, I'm just giving you a little bit of a gory detail for one of the interaction vertices. So again, there's nothing special about the vertex I've chosen. I could have just as well given you any other vertex, but the schematics are always the same. So I'm showing you how to essentially compute the three-point correlation function for one of these vertices here. And the important part now is, of course, we still have our overall coupling constant sitting here that in the overall interaction Hamiltonian I was trying to sell you as an argument for why we expect increased non-Gaussianity. So we still have this essentially enlarged contribution from having a larger epsilon here. But there's two other things we have to think about now. One is by looking at these increased slow roll parameters, really now there's some change to the temporal evolution of my scale factor, my speed of sound, and consequently also of the Hubble scale. And in particular, what that means is when I now start putting in these zeta functions in here, then upon canonical quantization, et cetera, I find these propagator terms uk in here. And they're given by this expression over here. And the interesting thing now is, I suppose, given that I have these different temporal dependencies of the slow roll, the speed of sound, of the scale factor A, et cetera, the overall temporal dependence of this UK propagator function here has changed. And that's really what's giving me the overall suppression term. So the cos gamma factor that we found that gives me an overall suppression really comes from the fact that I now have these different functions uk sitting inside my integral, and so they are sensitive to what exact functional form this takes, and that's giving me an overall suppression. And that effect actually ends up winning out massively over the increased contribution from just increasing my coupling constant epsilon over here. And that's really where the suppression's coming from the fact that we've modified the propagators that are living in our zeta by going to the non-slural limit. Okay. Does that actually, so can, does that sort of make sense?
So is it a state equilibrium in terms of K1 now?
Say again, is it a...
So the shapes that dominate the FNL, now you have, let's see, now the crossing is happening as KY equal to 1 instead of K tau equal to 1.
Right.
So the shapes now are determined by this other horizon.
Right, so you have a different, given that you have a CS, right, you have a horizon crossing that are different.
Right, so the shapes are going to be not the same or not the same.
Right, so you give me 10 minutes or so probably, I'll show you exactly what the shapes are going to be here. And there is some modification, actually, like you said.
So how far have you pushed the epsilon? They show a plot that up to epsilon.
Up to 0.3 without really any justification, right? So we'll find that, so the next thing I'll be talking about is the scale dependence, and that's really where the main bounds on the epsilon parameter are coming in. So up to now, I guess there's no reason for me not to go anywhere with epsilon, right? And we'll find that from scale dependence, then, you know, with a couple of assumptions that I'll point out, we'll find that actually I can only go up to 0.3. Otherwise, we'll start getting into strong coupling problems that I'll talk about. So essentially, yeah, within 5 minutes, I guess, I'll try and explain why we can only go up to 0.3, and then within 10 minutes, we'll go and talk about the shapes. So okay, so now let's think about the scale dependence of this three-point function. And I guess before I show you any of the detail, the schematic picture is a bit like this. So what we'll find is we start now looking at these slower violations, my epsilon parameter starts becoming bigger and bigger. And what we'll find is that generically this introduces a blue running non-Gaussianity. Now that's kind of interesting because as we'll see, I don't need to put anything in by hand to make this blue. And making it blue really means that whatever level of non-Gaussianity I have on CMB scales, I'll get larger and larger levels when I go to smaller scales. So if I look at galaxy cluster scales, I might generically expect a much larger non-Gaussian signal there. As we'll see, there's some interesting phenomenology when we look at large-scale structure that comes out of it. Now, I guess that's the nice and interesting part of it, but it also comes with a bit of a health and safety warning, I suppose. And namely, what we'll find is that if I have my non-Gaussianities increasing as I go to smaller scales, that's really telling me that, you know, the three-point correlation function is measuring essentially the interactions of my field phi here. And eventually, what we'll find, of course, is that when these interactions start becoming too large, then my theory really becomes strongly coupled, and I can't treat it perturbatively anymore. So essentially having a generically blue running will in that way actually give me some sort of constraint on how long I have a well-defined weakly coupled theory. And eventually, after a certain duration of this evolution, I find out that I run to a strong coupling regime, and I might still be able to do interesting things there, but certainly the predictions I'm giving you with this perturbative approach here aren't going to be valid anymore. So there's essentially some sort of validity regime where this perturbative treatment I'm proposing is actually valid. And then I guess then in turn, that's really where the constraint for slower violations will come from, because, you know, given that I have some slower violation, that'll give me a blue running, that will tell me how quickly I run into problems with strong coupling, and then by requiring some sort of minimal amount of inflation, that will give me a maximum value for slow-roll violation that I can still be happy with and keep going around the full circle here. Okay. So now let's start looking at some of the details. So again, we have this FNL parameter here, and we define this NNG function here in terms of the spectral dependence of this FNL parameter there. So again, we've simplified by not looking at the full shape yet, and just looking at the shape defined in some limit with this FNL equilateral. And now what we find in the blacked out region essentially corresponds to a slightly different spectral indices NS, of the two-point function. But what we find is a generic trend is that as we increase our slow-roll parameter epsilon, where here I'm in principle considering the full inflationary regime, my running of the three-point function becomes larger and larger and larger, And again, the interesting thing is that all of this is positive. So it's generically blue, so I generically expect larger non-Gaussianities and perhaps some interesting large-scale structure phenomenology. In fact, for exact scale invariance, we find this relation here. And again, the blacked out region corresponds to small corrections from the fact that I might not be exactly scale invariant at the level of the two-point function, but you know, my spectral index might be slightly red, for example.
That's confused. The previous plot you had when epsilon increased, FNL decreased.
Right, so this is an FNL. This is the spectral running. Sorry, this is essentially the spectral index for my three-point function.
But if it's positive, that means that
it gets larger with it. So the previous plot was for some fixed scale, sorry. So I was fixing parameters at some fixed scale, just looking at what happens at that scale as a change epsilon. And now I'm saying whatever the value at some fixed scale is, how does it change now when I move along the scale? Okay. So first of all, some interesting phenomenology that you might associate with that. So let's start looking at the right-hand plot over here. And I should say I've stolen these plots from Marilena and collaborators here. So I guess here we have some different scales we might be considering, going from CMB scales, galaxy bispectra, cluster scales. And here we have some effective FNL parameters. So the extreme slow roll case, again, like we were saying, is the one where we have scale invariance. So whatever FNL level we have at CMB scales, we just stay constant. And when we go along these different scales, we have the same level of the same amplitude of the three-point function as we go along. And now having this generic blue running is essentially corresponding to these different tilts here, where again, like we were saying, if we now go to smaller scales, we might expect higher levels of non-Gaussianity there. Now, why might we care, and what might be the interesting phenomenology associated with that? That's where we go to the left-hand plot. So say let's focus on just the pink lines up here, the top three lines. And what we find is that for some given CMB non-Gaussianity level, if we now look at different tilts, that they're parameterizing with this parameter k, which is essentially just some proportional to my epsilon parameter, that now if I introduce these different tilts, essentially if I have larger and larger positive skewness, so larger three-point correlation functions, I actually find an increase in this plot. What am I actually increasing? So the thing I'm plotting is essentially the number of galaxy clusters over some limiting mass per unit redshift, per square degree of sky versus redshift. And again, what I find is that now essentially, the number of clusters I see on these smaller scales on the right-hand side here is a direct probe of the level of non-Gaussianity I find here. So in principle, and I guess in principle is quite important because there's quite a few degeneracies I might be thinking about, but in principle, there's an effect here where by looking at galaxy clusters and just doing number counts on this scale here, I can in principle put error bars on my primordial non-Gaussianity here, and then I'll do the same trick at CMB scales. So perhaps in the not too distant future, I can actually put error bars all over this plot somehow, and that way constrain how big my running is and whether there's any running at all, actually. Okay. So now now going back to from the nice and interesting bits to the maybe also nice and interesting, but also potentially problematic bits, and namely, that's now these strong coupling constraints. So like we were saying, we have these generically blue runnings. So we have increased non-Gaussianity, increased self-interactions of my incident field phi as I go to smaller and smaller scales. So as in fact, Louis and Sarah were working out not too far back. So now you need to really be worried about these strong coupling bounds. So really what we're saying we want to have some perturbative treatment, some perturbative working out of these different endpoint correlation functions like we're doing to remain valid. And what we find is a very rough bound is that once essentially the action of the perturbations to cubic order, so the cubic action I was showing you earlier on, compared to what I find at the quadratic order, if that's not much, much smaller than one, I go into a strong coupling regime. And that's really quite problematic from the point of view here, because there's different ways of essentially phrasing the same argument, but one of the ways of thinking about this is essentially loop corrections are no longer suppressed here anymore. So working out things at tree level is all fine and well, but it's really nowhere near the complete answer at all. So if I go into this regime where this condition is no longer satisfied, I should really be doing some QCD-style lattice treatment or something, some clever way of resumming to get my full answer. And perturbatively treating things by expanding around some perturbative regime really doesn't give me the right answer anymore. Yes, you can rephrase the same argument that we were making about loop corrections in terms of unitarity cutoffs from partial wave amplitudes, and I've just put them in for show essentially here. But the main point really being this, there's some regime where I can really trust the predictions I'm making here, where the perturbative analysis is valid. But if my three-point correlation functions as measured by this cubic action here become too large so that this constraint is violated, then that's no longer true, and I really can't trust my perturbative treatment here anymore. Now, what does that mean for our running non-Gaussianities here? So this is probably the simplest plot I have in the whole talk, but the one I find most difficult to explain. So let's see how well we fare here. So what I'm thinking of now, so I'm saying, well, I want to say there's some minimum amount of e-folds that I want my inflationary theory to be weakly coupled for, so my predictions to be valid. And the pink line I'm showing you here is essentially the minimal phenomenological line where I'm saying I just want 10 e-folds as a minimal phenomenological requirement for some scaling phase that essentially gives me all the directly observationally accessible scales from CMB down to galaxy cluster scales where I can disentangle non-Gaussianities. Outside of these 10 e-folds, you know, perhaps inflation is a multi-step process, perhaps there's a phase transition, something happens, I don't know, I don't care. As a minimal phenomenological requirement, let's have these 10 e-folds. And the game I'm playing here now is I'm saying, okay, so on the smallest scales, I just want to be just inside the perturbative regime, and I guess that essentially corresponds to having an FNL of the order of 10 to the 4 or so. So if you think of what the value of the curvature perturbation is, you get factors of 10 to the minus 5 sitting in there. So really what that's telling you is once my FNL reaches 10 to the 5, then the level of non-Gaussianity and the contribution from my two-point function are about the same level, and I'm starting to be in the strong coupling regime. So as a sort of, I guess naive guess, I'm saying, okay, let's be an order of magnitude below that so that we're not in the strong coupling regime. We have an FNL of 10 to the 4 on the smallest scale I'm interested in. And now what the pink line is showing you is as I increase my epsilon, what's the maximum number I can have on the largest scales, on CMB scales? I guess what that's showing you is that if I have 10 to the 4 about 10 e-folds in on galaxy cluster scales, then on CMB scales, I can really have at most an order of FNL of 100 or so if I go up to 0.3. So that's really where the 0.3 is somehow coming from. I'm saying in the optimistic scenario where on CMB scales I have some FNL of the order of 100 or so that we'll see, hopefully soon with Planck, for example, then if I want the minimum amount of e-folds to cover the observational range, then I can't go larger than 0.3 if I don't want to run out into the strong coupling regime on smaller scales. Now, what the blue line is showing is essentially saying, well, let's not just have essentially the number of scales from CMB but to galaxy cluster scales, but let's double the amount of scales, so corresponding to about 15 e-folds or so. And what we find then, of course, is that if we now want to stay for a larger number of scales in the perturbative regime, then, of course, constraints become stronger because I still have this running. So if I have to stay in the perturbative regime for a larger number of scales, then I need to be more careful here, and I need to be weakly coupled for a longer period in the evolution, and that makes my bound stronger. So if I now want essentially an extra form of orders of magnitudes of scale, so 16 e-folds rather than 10, roughly, then I find that if on the smallest scales now I want to have an FNL of the order of 10 to the 4 or so, then really even if I just want to have something that's order 1 or so, my epsilon has to be even smaller than 0.2. But I guess the pink line really is essentially the minimal phenomenological line, where I'm saying as a minimal requirement, 10 e-folds of inflation, and then in the optimistic scenario where I have a detectable FNL on CMB scales, then I really want an epsilon parameter which is smaller than 0.3 to cover these 10 e-folds and to stay in a weakly coupled regime over these ranges of scales.
Right. Something else has to explain why the universe is like
this. Right, exactly. So what we're saying here. Yeah, so if you want to make this run for 60 e-folds, then that's basically just telling you are in extreme slow roll. But I guess given that we're not really doing model building here, the game we're playing is just from as a minimal observational requirement, we'll need these 10 e-folds. And then, you know, like we were saying, perhaps there's a multi-step process, perhaps there's a phase transition to a different phase. Something happens, whatever it is, that resolves horizon problems, etc. But as a minimal requirement to actually match the scaling phase that we can observe, we definitely need some phase that does 10 e-folds. So that's essentially all I'm concerned with here, just from a minimal phenomenological requirement. I'm not trying to say that there's some intrinsic naturalness and we don't need to care about the other problems.
I think that's probably even too strong, because nobody has really looked at this. I think 10 e-fold is, so we go from a scale of like 1,000 megaparsec down to what is scale? Megaparsec, or?
Well, I guess in terms of inverse scales, we're thinking of three orders of magnitude, right? Ish. So
that's
in terms.
7 e-fold is 1,000, right?
Yeah, so I guess what I'm saying here is here I've got three orders of magnitude, right? Sitting there. What essentially with the 10 e-folds requirement, I'm saying, we have a little bit of leeway either side. If I really want to squeeze it and say the absolute bare minimum is 7, maybe 8 e-folds or so, then I guess I could push this a little bit further. But I'm trying to be reasonably conservative here.
So I mean, what you need to do if you want to do this systematically is to look at the corrections to the power spectrum and see whether that's going to destroy the scale invariance. Because there are bounds on the power spectrum, and they kind of blow up around a megaparsec or so. But I mean, that's really the only constraint that we have, right? That's where the 10-fold can come from, is that the power spectrum is the scale invariant for a bound.
Right, but so the power spectrum we can match arbitrarily, and that's not the problem,
well,
right? Like you were saying earlier.
Well, if you can do that, then there is no problem.
Yeah, but it's constrained on the equilateral non-Gaussianity essentially on small scale.
Second?
So let's say the equilateral non-Gaussianity is going up.
Right.
Now the order of the tree of infinite form.
Right.
It could be anything on small scale. Equilateral is not very well on galaxies.
True. Yeah. But that's good, right? That's interesting in terms of actually getting interesting phenomenology. So if it's large, but within a regime where I could control my theory here, that's perfect. That's exactly what I, That's what I dream of.
I guess the question is, it could be that the physics limitation is strongly coupled.
Which would be cool, right? But then, like we were saying yesterday, then we need to think of some clever way of thinking about the strongly coupled regime. So I guess there's nothing bad and evil about going into the strongly coupled regime, short of us not really understanding it properly yet. But in principle, I guess there's no reason that you have to say you have to stop when you reach strong coupling. You keep going in your inflationary phase there, and like we're saying, there might be interesting phenomenology there too.
Yeah, my concern is that it's what you call a strong coupling is an arbitrary thing. That is it like, should it be 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 or I don't know, what is a strong coupling? I mean, we don't really have.
I can work out, so given some particular theory, I can work out what the loop corrections are to that theory, right? So
that's my point, that if you want to do this quantitatively, then you want to say, so you can't work out that total production.
Right, so if it's 10 to the 5, I'm in that.
They are less than the observation. So there's an exact comparison. This is the comparison of loop corrections to the observational errors.
Right.
And when the loop corrections become bigger than observational errors, then you can trust them.
So that's essentially what that's doing, right? So if we're in the 10 to the 5 regime, then you can see that the loop corrections are much larger. I can't trust my tree level predictions anymore, whereas if I go below that bound, then where exactly the transition happens, you'll see, but at 4 or so, I'd say.
I think heuristically, I agree with you, but I don't really know anybody has done this calculation. Because
Louis would be the right person to talk to, I think.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part. But.
So I think the quantitative comparison is the comparison of observational error with loop correction.
Not sure, just because the point is that your model becomes non-predictive. So it's not so much that it doesn't matter the observational errors. The point is that the Lagrangian does not predict anymore what the point is. So you don't know if you're getting the right answer at all. So it could be that when you reach the strong coupling regime, for some reason, there's a boost factor in the power spectrum, gross factor of 100, that model is ruled out, and you have no way of doing it because you cannot compute that.
Yeah.
And that regime. So it's just that when your theory reaches strong coupling regime, it could be ruled out, and you're unaware of it.
I don't think we're disagreeing, but anyway, I was just saying that this there is no quantitative, as far as I know, there is no quantitative work that says So I mean, I agree that's the kind of calculation, but I do, but that calculation depends on the actual observations.
Right.
I mean, there are two different. One is a theoretical constraint.
You have theoretical error and you have observational error.
Yeah, but I mean, first, the point is that how much we trust our theoretical calculation.
But, so this is more like they were saying. This is more than a theoretical error or something, right? This is not some uncertainty in my computation.
Right.
It's just saying that my perturbative treatment breaks down. So I can still have theoretical control over my model if I know how to deal with the strong coupling regime. But you know, given that I don't right now, I'll try and stay away from that regime.
But I guess what I'm saying is that it's too late by the time that the theoretical framework breaks down. But you always have some theoretical error, which is a small and not
right.
And it blows up as you go to a smaller scale, theoretical error becomes bigger. Theoretically, I know it blows up because of the loops become bigger.
And I guess when you're actually saying somehow.
When they get them in the same order, you should stop trusting.
That's
right.
Okay. So when the theoretical error becomes bigger than
the
observational error, then you don't trust them. That's my point. And I think that the proper comparison, does that make sense? No.
I don't understand that statement, because I would just say, you know, it's just saying in perturbation theory, I can only do that as long as my next term is small compared to the thing before, unless it becomes in the same order. I just can't say anything anymore. Unless I'm
that's right.
Sort of
but I'm saying it's already...
It doesn't have anything.
No, the problem happens before that.
No, but I think so what Niaj is saying is even before I completely lose control, I might start getting corrections from these higher order terms. And so I want to think about them as well. But yes, what I'm saying is more put back, so I'm saying at some level I just have no control anymore. And so you know I'm staying well clear of that level where I have good control over it. Right. How are we doing for time actually? So about 10 minutes? Wow, this is generous, next to 3 minutes. Okay, so where are we at? There we go. So essentially, I guess the same thing I was saying right now before is kind of also summarized in this geometric plot here. So again, we have the curve from Euler-Lyon, where this black line or this black shaded region here is just showing you how the running of my 3-point function depends on my slow roll parameter epsilon here. And now these green and yellow shaded regions are basically saying, well, if I have in the green region, if I have an FNL of the order of 100 or so on CMB scales, then I can really go up to at most 0.3 or so in terms of my slow roll parameter if I want to stay weakly coupled in the weakly coupled regime for 10 E folds of inflation. And obviously, if I make the amplitude of non-Gaussianities lower on some pivot scale like the CMB scale here, then I can keep running for longer. So what the yellow region is showing me that if I say, okay, we only have an FNL of the order of 1 or so on CMB scales, then in fact I can go up to 0.5 or so in terms of my slow roll parameter epsilon here before my perturbative treatment breaks down. So I guess the 0.3 bound is really somehow a combination of saying my theory has to stay weakly coupled plus some justified or unjustified optimism about the amount of non-Gaussianity we might discover at CMB scales. So in the observationally optimistic scale where we have an FNL of the order of 100 at CMB scales, then I can't have more slow roll violation in the epsilon of up to 0.3 or so, otherwise things start breaking down. But as we were seeing early on, even if I only go to 0.3, that already has a dramatic effect on the amplitude of the 3-point correlation function at a given scale, order of magnitude suppression or so. Okay, so now a very quick look at different shapes of non-Gaussianities here. So again, we saw quite a bit of that in Yi's talk 2 days ago. I guess let's show you what I'm plotting exactly first. So what I'm plotting really here is essentially some dimensionless measure of the bispectrum curly A here. So that's exactly what I'm plotting. Just some dimensionless parameterization of what my bispectrum looks like. And I guess one of the interesting things about looking at shapes now here is that they're of course more complicated in the potential forms they could take than just looking at some one value parameter defined in some limit. But there's some fairly generic features that can tell us about the underlying physics that's going on. So these equilateral type shapes, for example, they tend to be very easily generatable when you have non-standard kinetic terms, which is really why even in the slow roll limit early on for these single field models, we find that that's a very generic type of non-Gaussianity we can generate. We might have some different types of Enon Gaussianis, for example, local ones, which peak in this squeeze configuration here, and we find the fact that we can't generate them in single degree of freedom models, thanks to some work by von Maracina and Clemieri and Matthias here. So that would really be, if we find significant local non-Gaussianity, for example, that would really tell us something about that we physically have to have more than one degree of freedom to play here, or some vastly different model. And of course, I can think of different signatures with, from different fancy physics that might be putting it. But the main point being that by looking at the shape and fairly broad features of it, there's already a lot I can learn about the physics that's going on. Now, what I'm interested in here, now remember earlier on, I was slightly lying, I suppose, when I said we have predominantly equilateral non-Gaussianities, and I was telling you that, in fact, even in the slower limit, we have some small region of parameter space where that's not really true. Now, that's what these guys have worked out here, and essentially what I'm showing you is some sort of correlation of the overall shape as I vary my parameters with the equilateral shape, which is the same that we saw earlier on here, just with a negative sign, something that peaks in the far corner over here. And what we find as we go along parameter space, so what they're doing is they're essentially fixing all the parameters and only varying this lambda over sigma parameter we saw earlier on. What we find is that we essentially have a correlation of minus one or one for vast regions of parameter space. But it's some little quibble here of the order of step of 10 or so in this extra parameter. I actually find different shapes, namely the so-called orthogonal or unfolded shape, which essentially peak in the squashed configuration for my triangle.
Can you say
what are the axes? So this is just the amplitude of my function.
The
bottom,
yeah.
What are these here? So
right.
This is essentially the correlation, some cross product between the different shapes, and this axis here is just this extra free parameter they're keeping. So the lambda over sigma parameter we're playing with, and essentially the thing that measures the third derivative of your action. Now, the point being here, we have a very small region where we have a non-equilateral shape, and in fact, it's still staying within coupling, strong coupling constraints, we can easily go up to orders of 100 or so. So this is a small region of parameter space where we can get these different types of signals, different shapes. Now, the way this is modified by now going away from slow roll is essentially this gets spread out massively as a feature of the suppression that we found. So rather than having the small order 10 in measure in terms of this parameters region here, where I find these different new interesting shapes, this now again gets enhanced by about an order of magnitude or so. So in some sense, I'm now much more likely to see these different types of shapes, because I now have a bigger region of parameter space, again, bigger by an order of magnitude or so in terms of phase space volume, where I find these new interesting orthogonal and folded shapes, as they are called. So that's the way how shapes get affected by slow roll violations. You don't get qualitatively new shapes, but essentially you get different regions of parameter space here which are enhanced. Now, in particular, sort of interesting region where we don't get equilateral shapes now becomes bigger. So that's essentially how these shapes are associated. So I guess if I'm really trying to sell this here, I'd say if you see a shape like this now, then that's somehow perhaps hinting at a slow roll violating model, because in these models we're really we're much more likely in some sense to actually see these shapes turning up. Okay, so I guess that's a summary of the what happens for these different non-Gaussian signatures. So what we find is in these fast rolling models where we go up to 0.3 because of constraints from the running and from the strong coupling regimes, what we find is we find generically suppressed non-Gaussianities at any given scale. And that's interesting because it now broadens up my parameter space. And regions of my parameter space, which I thought were ruled out already, now might come back in. I find this generically large blue running, which is interesting in terms of large-scale structure phenomenology. But I also need to start worrying about how valid my perturbative treatment is and for some number of scales. And that gives me constraints on this parameter. And I find this slightly modified shape space. And I guess the sort of this plot here, down here, these plots are somehow summarizing these different findings. So on the left-hand side here, I'm plotting the overall non-Gaussian shape for some fixed set of parameters in the slow roll regime. What I find is I have an amplitude of the order of 1,000 or so, which again is way outside WMAP bounds that we have already. So this is something that's already ruled out right now in this choice of parameters. But in the slow roll regime, because if we now increase my slow roll parameters and look at how my how my three-point function evolves at that given scale, and I'll find that rather than having an amplitude of the order of 1,000 or so, I go back to an amplitude of 80 or so, so it's pressure by more than an order of magnitude, and I've changed from a shape that's equilateral to one that's orthogonal. So that's how the shape space is modified, and also the overall amplitude. So I'm not really going to talk about, I guess, the tensor to scalar ratio. The main point being here is that right now, you can also, you can in principle get constraints on my epsilon parameter from the tensor to scalar ratio. Right now, as we'll find, is even if we are not model general, they're not competitive. So this is in fact only for DBI style action, where I fixed my PX phi function to be a particular form. If I'm more general, actually this sound doesn't even tell me I have to be in inflation. But the point being here that as I go along in the near future, if I can constrain my R parameter to be much smaller than what I can constrain it to be today, perhaps the strongest constraint might come actually if you look at the tensor to scalar ratio, but not presently. That's the main point here. Don't have time to talk about it. And I guess the finally, a little advertisement of some people's work is kind of following up on this. So Thorsten and Jan in Göttingen, they're essentially looking at the types of models we're looking at here and preparing them for Planck style analysis, where you don't think of separable shapes, but some of shape independently constraining everything. They found there are good convergence properties. So essentially what that's telling is that Planck should be able to constrain these models very well. And of course, the fiducial model we've been playing with is a PX5 model, and I've told you it's in principle easy to generalize this to more complicated effective field theories for a single degree of freedom. So, for example, Takeshi and Sita and people, they've been writing down analogous results for generalization to models of this type, but in principle I could generalize to single models to other effective field theories that are even more general for a single degree of freedom. So, I guess, if that works now? No? Yes, there you go. That's kind of a summary. So like we're saying, we derived some bounds on these Slorov violations and hopefully some signatures that you might find observationally intriguing. So that's really all for me. Thanks.
Yes. So in the analysis, you basically assume epsilon as a constant.
Right.
And this corresponds to Paul or background evolution.
Yes.
So it's hard to imagine for a generic potential, the generic solution will not be a pure power.
Right. So
what happens if your epsilon is not pure constant, it's a function of time.
Right. So I guess in principle, the most general type of Slorov violations you could be thinking of here is really one where you know it's not constant, but you have these higher order parameters floating about. So in some way we're actually thinking about this at the moment. So in a sense, that's a combination of this generalized Slorov approach that people are looking at, where they're ignoring these epsilon parameters, but looking at a feature like oscillation of these higher order parameters and what we've done. So what we're looking at right now, we're just starting, but you know, still looking at it, is essentially if you combine the two approaches and the formalism is measurable, then you could really think of some generic feature. Now, I guess the challenge there is not to do it in principle, it's to say something interesting analytically. Because you know you still have to keep things being handled. But in principle, all the machinery is out there. So I guess that's just essentially one interesting limit, and then the stuff they've been looking at is the other interesting limit, and now we're trying to mesh the two approaches. I'm not sure I want to hazard a guess yet as to what's going. The guess I will hazard is essentially you'll probably have some constant Slorov violations at the background level of this sort, and then on top of that, you might have some sort of oscillatory features. And that's really essentially where the two different things will come from. And you'll need to make sure that your features are not too steep, so you get large non-Gaussian entities that are outside bounds, et cetera, et cetera. So you get some combined constraint. But what exactly that will be, I guess we'll see.
There was this paper recently by Justin Curry and they used a strong component limit.
Right. So all the work I've been showing you is on inflationary style theories, right? So yes, we Federico, who's working on this stuff with us, and Justin, they're way back looking also at contracting scenarios. And then in principle, you can do things for, you know, varying speed of sound scenarios where you can have superluminal propagations, etc. So what Justin was looking at was essentially putting some strong coupling bound on the superluminal type models. And so he derived this essentially 25 e-folds, and then you get into strong coupling regimes there. Not in because of the three-point function, but in fact because of the essentially the amplitude of your two-point function. That turns out to be the constraining factor there.
Maybe like there was another one before that by Bauman et al. That they did the
right.
Subluminal. And my question is, so there they just take the L3, the cubic terms, and compare it to the quadratic term and get the strong coupling unit.
Right.
But since you are also violating the Slorov conditions in both spaces, and it looks like here you're saying that you shouldn't just look at the, just, you might have modification of what exactly the strong limit the coupling. It's not just the coupling that matters, right? You're saying the operators change.
To some extent, I guess, really in a way, this is kind of building on what they've done, right? Because they find the same thing, that you only have about 10 e-folds or so where you stay in the strong, in the weakly coupled regime, sorry. So essentially, I guess what we're doing is saying, well, now they're essentially using that as putting a constraint on parodic style models and saying for what duration they're weakly coupled, and saying, well, inflation is interesting because there you don't have this constraint in the Slorov limit. We can keep going arbitrarily long. So I guess what we are doing is essentially switching around the argument here, saying, well, now let's use the same reasoning to actually look at inflationary style models and constrain parameter space there. Then again, requiring those minimum 10 number of e-folds, that's what that tells us about parameter space constraints like Slorov violation, and here's the interested phenomenology.
All I'm saying is that you did the same calculation, because what seemed to me there is that the main assumption there is that all the modes resolve like at the Hubble crossing, and then they can give you the major contribution to the cubic term. And then
right.
The couplings are the most important things there. But I got the impression for your talk, the coupling themselves deceiving. You could have other effects going in there.
Because they're really looking at the Slorov case, right? So there you don't have these modifications to the propagator. So they're looking to the Slorov case for inflation, and they're looking to some ekparotic contraction style phase. And that's really
varying,
the one.
But
sorry?
If I'm looking at the sound varying situation, then I have to worry about the
right.
Correlation that you're pointing at.
Right.
Yeah, and I guess, when people estimate the size of the cubic term, usually we just put zeta to be its variance. You say the term is of order this, so you look at the coefficient, and then you say zeta is of order of its variance.
Right.
H over
right.
But now, because you're when you actually perform the calculation in the fast world regime, you're going to have this cosine alpha gamma alpha.
Right. They actually give you an extra suppression.
Right. So the question I think is: are you including these in your estimate? Are you including these cosine alpha and gamma alpha in your estimate of where the strong contribution is, or are you just doing the old-fashioned way of just putting the variance?
So I guess the main thing where that really becomes relevant is in terms of, so when the bit that I was skipping over with the tensor scalar ratio, that's really reliant on you having some lower bound on the speed of sound, which again is kind of that's essentially from both from observations but also from where you get into strong coupling, because it's one of the coupling constants that scales everything. So there, what we've done is only take the naive pre-value. So in fact, the constraints might actually get worse from the tensor to scalar ratio, if you start incorporating the full propagator behavior that you find here now. For the non-Gaussian part, yes, so we did take that into account. So then the strong coupling bounds are still fine there.
So how did you take that into account?
Well, because it's still really it's still a naive way of estimating it, but there it should definitely be valid, because all you care about really is, in some sense, it's just thinking about what size your cubic action is. Right? So looking at the relative contribution of the full cubic action is still all you care about with respect to the quadratic action.
Varies with time and
that's what I'm saying. Just taking the variance can change in time. If you have some sound speed that is changing fast, it's not in a slow order.
I'm taking the variance of.
So usually, so let's say naively, what I do is say I have a grad zeta in there, and I have like zeta dot in there. I usually just put one as CSK, the other one as eta, and then cancel out. If CS is almost constant, I am in a slower regime. I can make an estimate for that and then calculate the ratio.
Right.
But now, if my CS is changing very fast because you are not in a slower regime anymore, then this term becomes very time dependent.
True, but I can still analytically compute my full propagators, coupling constants, prefactors, etc., even in that regime.
But it changes like for every k that's happening at this
right.
time, and it's not anymore in a like all every equilateral. The triangles are not.
No. Right. So, but the. Mm-hmm. So, but what you find is essentially because you only have one number here, one time parameter, the CS squared. That's essentially scaling the overall amplitude of your three-point function still. So you find that essentially by looking at some given shape of the scale dependence, you're covering all bases here. If you think of, for example, this lambda over sigma parameter, these higher order parameters, if you introduce extra time dependence there, that's not just proportional to CS squared or something, then you could also have shapes that are changing with scale. And then I really need to start thinking about that. But as long as I have just some fixed shape, essentially, that's scale dependent by some overall scale factor, then I'm fine just still looking at the shape and at the limit. Cool. Thank you.